You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everybody. We're going to get started. My name is Justin Weiss. I'm a senior fellow at the Center in the U.S. and Europe here at Brookings. I'd like to welcome all of you at Brookings this afternoon for a debate on the rise of populism in Europe and the United States, a debate that we have organized in partnership with our friends at the Heinrich Böll Foundation, who have also been working on these issues recently. The discussion on populism is both very easy and very difficult to introduce. It's easy because everybody can see that there is a populist wave on both sides of the Atlantic and that it is indeed a very worrying development. If only one looks at the cover of the National Interest, the piece by Ian Kershaw on fascism returns, or does it, on the wave of populism in Europe, or one looks at Christopher Caldwell's piece on Marine Le Pen in the Weekly Standard of this week, there's a sort of evidence of this issue. Indeed, in France, it was a huge shock when a week ago Marine Le Pen, who's now the head of the National Front, appeared in first position in a poll for the first round of the presidential election. That is before current President Nicolas Sarkozy and most likely socialist contender Dominique Strauss-Kahn with 24% of the of intentions of vote against 21 for each of them. And this, the National Front, the Front National, is a party which wants to take France out of the euro, which wants to take France out of the Schengen European zone, out of NATO also, establish national preference and deny welfare to immigrants, as well as put an end to family reunification, restore the death penalty, and relocalize jobs in France by favoring economic patriotism. In the piece by Chris Caldwell, Marine Le Pen herself is comparing the Front National to the Tea Party movement. She says this is a third force that represents, in her words, the emergence of, once again, a third force next to the two organized powers, that is to say, the Socialist Party and the UMP, the two main parties. On the U.S. side, while there are indeed very serious policy proposals put forward by the Tea Party movement, some of the supporters of that movement advocate the abolition of the Federal Reserve, a ban on driver's licenses in some states, not raising the federal debt ceiling, encouraging states to sign constitutional compacts among them so as to escape the implementation of the healthcare reform, revising the 14th Amendment so as to allow states to issue a separate birth certificate for the kids of for the children of undocumented immigrants. So there's a sort of evidence of the issue, and we see these forces rising throughout Europe, but also to some extent in the U.S. Now, beyond this obvious rise, which everyone can see, you know, sort of we know it when we see it, and the fact that it's worrying, the discussion is also difficult to introduce for at least three reasons. The first one is that the concept of populism itself is very complex. It's obviously not a political party. It's not even a coherent ideology. It can be from the right, it can be from the left, or even from the center. Rather than an ideology, it's really a tendency, it's an aspect or a characteristic of otherwise pretty different political movements, such as the one we will discuss today, as opposed to the central doctrine of these movements. Second, populism is not only a complex term, but it's also a loaded term, because it was associated with distasteful movements in the past, especially in Europe, and it can be used as an epithet. As a result, any discussion of populism is politically sensitive. And indeed, academics and experts like us can all the more easily be accused of abusing the term, that they are precisely the type of elites that populists criticize for their patronizing attitudes vis-à-vis the people. What we call populist, they can call simply popular or the expression of common sense. Third, comparing the U.S. to Europe is not self-evident. Each continent has a rich history of populist movements, but obviously the European historical record of populism is ripe with horrible tragedies, while the American one is not. When the Great Depression struck in the 1930s, populism rose on both sides of the Atlantic, but Roosevelt was elected in the US while Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. And on many counts, indeed, the Tea Party movement in the US is decidedly different from the various anti-immigrant and nationalist political formations which have gained strength across Europe in recent years. Still, they do have things in common. And in order to establish that comparison, I would like to try to offer a definition of populism before asking our speakers to tell us their views. And I should say that I'm happy to be refuted by either of you. Populism is, I would suggest, about power, identity, and anger. It's about power because it attacks elites of all kinds, from technocrats to plutocrats and politicians, and it exalts the power and the values of the common man, the forgotten majority, which are shortchanged and despised by these elites. About identity, second, populism hates globalism and emphasizes the role of natural or pre-political units like the nation, the region, or the ethnic group. Third, populism is always the expression of a profound discontent with the current order and the way the social contract has evolved to the detriment of certain categories or certain classes. You know the quote, "I am mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore," to use the 1970s cry of protests. This protest often leads to the scapegoating of certain groups and institutions and sometimes even to conspiracy theories. Let me now give the floor to our two speakers of today, and I will introduce them in the order in which they will speak. Bill Galston here is a senior fellow at Brookings, where he holds the Ezra Zilka Chair in Governance Studies. He's a former advisor to President Clinton and also to various presidential candidates. He's an expert on domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections. But he is also, like Pierre, a political philosopher by training. He was previously a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he specialized on issues of public philosophy and political institutions. I should add that he has also worked a lot in the past 10 years on the polarization of the American political landscape. And more recently, he was the co-founder of No Labels, a political organization dedicating to restoring civility in politics and fight the negative effects of excessive partisanship. Pierre Asner is an associate research fellow at CERI, at Sciences Po, the International Research Center at Sciences Po in Paris. Pierre had a brush with some of the deadliest forms of European populism himself since he was born in Romania in the early 1930s. He arrived in France as a student in 1948 and attended the École Normale Supérieure between 1952 and 1955, becoming a professor of philosophy and a disciple of Raymond Aron in the mid-50s. He was a Rockefeller Fellow in the U.S. in the 2 years afterwards, and then he's been with CERI since the end of the 50s and has also taught at Johns Hopkins University. His work on international relations, as well as on democracy and totalitarian regimes, and the role of passions in politics, has been deeply influenced by this early experience and also of his being a student of political philosophy. So, Bill, why don't you go first? The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, your staff, for taking the initiative in organizing this meeting. Thanks also to the Center and the Foundation for making it possible. And I also have to say it's a pleasure to share the podium with a thinker whose work I have admired ever since I was a graduate student more than 40 years ago. And I look forward to discussing with you for the next hour and a half Kant's political writings. Just kidding, Justin. I want to make... This is not a topic about which I've written previously, but I welcome the invitation to spend some time trying to think it through. And so the remarks that I'm about to make are very preliminary and, I would say, imperfectly organized, but I thought it would be useful to get them on the table, and perhaps they can be perfected through objection. The first point that I want to make is that elements of populism are very much inherent in what I will call the cultural DNA of the United States. The single most influential work of political writing in the 18th century in the colonies was Cato's Letters by Trenchard and Gordon, which represented the distilled essence of the views of the Country Party, the group opposed to the centralization of power and the corruption of the court, and the precursor of what became the Whigs. And Trenchard and Gordon in Cato's Letters put together a highly appealing, if not entirely coherent, combination of liberty-loving, verging on libertarianism, with classical republicanism. That this volume of letters, which it is said was on the bookshelf of 50% of American households by the 1770s, was not devoid of consequences, becomes apparent in one of the great pieces of 18th century political rhetoric, namely Edmund Burke's second speech on conciliation with the American colonies, delivered in 1775. And here are a couple of outtakes which will give you Burke's understanding of the cultural DNA of the emerging United States. He says famously, "All Protestantism, even the most cold and passive, is a sort of dissent. But the religion most prevalent in our northern colonies," that's American colonies, "is a refinement on the principles of resistance. It is the dissidence of dissent and the Protestantism of the Protestant religion." And then farther down, and even more pertinently for our current discussion, Burke says, and I quote, "In other countries, the people, more simple and of a less mercurial cast, judge of an ill principle in government only by an actual grievance. But in the American colonies, they anticipate the evil and judge of the pressure of the grievance by the badness of the principle. They augur misgovernment at a distance and sniff the approach of tyranny in every tainted breeze." And thus it has been for every iteration of populism in the United States since the founding of the Republic. Which brings me to my next point, that is, there have been cycles of populist upsurge throughout American history, starting with the Jacksonian movement, the Know-Nothings, the populist movement and party of the 1880s and 1990s, a kind of a left populism during the New Deal, the populism of post-World War II anti-internationalism, and then the latest populist wave, which in my judgment began in 1968 and has never completely abated since then. The next point, and here I agree with all of the spirit and much of the letter of Justin's opening remarks, there are some persistent structural features of American populism from beginning to end. And as we'll see later on in my remarks, there are differences among the upsurges of American populism, but these, I think, are persistent features. First, of course, anti-elitism. And in America, this consists in a brisk movement from the proposition, "I'm as good as you are, morally speaking, all of us are created equal," to, without passing go, a suspicion of all social hierarchies, including hierarchies based on knowledge and expertise. The purest expression of this spirit in contemporary American politics is Sarah Palin, but in our lifetime, one thinks of George Wallace and his denunciation of pointy-headed intellectuals, and what Ronald Reagan said on the eve of his first run for governor of California. And by the way, to avoid misunderstanding, let me say I do not view Reagan as a populist, but I do view Reagan as someone who was very good at drawing on the strength of populist sensibilities without succumbing to the ills of populism. If you're interested in my developed views on that, I'll be happy to share them with you. At any rate, here's what Reagan said. Quote, "I am not a politician. I am an ordinary citizen with a deep-seated belief that much of what troubles us has been brought about by politicians. And it's high time that more ordinary citizens brought the breath of common sense thinking to bear on these problems." Common sense. The wisdom of the people is good enough. A second defining feature is particularism, a particularism that manifests itself in family and ethnic ties and also in loyalty to what is near and familiar. One of the consequences of that kind of particularism is mistrust of large and distant institutions, whether corporations or domestic political centers of power, and a fortiori international institutions. Which brings me to the next structural feature of American populism. It is a kind of irritable nationalism. It stands against international laws and institutions. Its spirit is summed up in the New Hampshire Revolutionary banner, "Don't tread on me." It is not shy about self-assertion, and it insists on American exceptionalism and harshly criticizes leaders who are seen as denying it or qualifying it in any way. The next defining feature of American populism, a sense of power disadvantage, if not outright powerlessness, a sense of being beleaguered, a sensibility which at the extremes breeds a willingness to entertain conspiracy theories. For a good catalog of this history, I direct you to a famous essay by the historian Richard Hofstadter on what he called the paranoid style in American politics. And beginning with McCarthyism, he works backward through the populist party's belief in a gold conspiracy beginning in right after the Civil War, to anti-Catholic screeds against papal conspiracies before the Civil War, to an anti-Masonic populist panic that swept the United States in the 1790s based on the proposition that the Bavarian Illuminati were on the verge of taking over the country. And the Bavarian Illuminati continued to pop up from time to time in the conspiracy theories of Lyndon LaRouche, just to show you that no bad idea ever dies in the United States. Another important ingredient of populism American style is what I would call a sense of dispossession. Let me define that. It is the sense that our country is slipping away from us, or worse, has been taken away from us. And we need to fight to keep it if it's just slipping, or to take it back if it's been taken away. In that sense, though not in all other senses, American populism is always conservative. It is always backward-looking. It always says we want to preserve the good old ways against these alien threats. Throughout the history of American populism, there have been different categories of this sense of dispossession: the cultural and religious, the ethnic and racial, the social, focused on crime and disruption as foes of the social order that populists in America tend to prize, the political, state or federal power mobilized against community control, or unelected judges wielding power against the majority of the people. And finally, the sense of dispossession can be economic, as it was in the 1890s with the decline in the agricultural economy, and as it has been since the 1970s with the decline of the manufacturing economy. Next defining feature of American populism, a focus on individual liberty and the protection of individual liberty, which is not to be confused with outright libertarianism. So populists in the United States today are against the individual health care mandate, but not Social Security. They're against what they regard as federal intrusion, but they are hardly against all funded federal programs, as the new majority in the House of Representatives is about to discover. American populists are characterized by a moralized outlook. Politics is a struggle of good versus evil with no middle ground, and therefore compromise is a dirty word. Characterized by apocalyptic thinking, there is a threat to liberty. It is grave. It is immediate. And if we do not stand our ground and fight here and now, all is lost. Which brings me to the final section of these introductory remarks, having to do with some of the special characteristics of the wave of populism that erupted in the late 1960s and has not really subsided ever since. And let me just offer some very brief brushstrokes here. To some extent, this populism, one must admit it, was racially motivated, but I don't want to exaggerate that into a pervasive or dominant feature. And part of it took the form of opposition to elites who were seen as doing battle against homogeneous local communities. The great example of that is the school busing controversy that erupted in Boston pursuant to a famous court order, and which was described in, I think, a book of enduring value, Common Ground, by Tony Lucas. In part, contemporary populism is about the ethnic diversification. We all talk about the civil rights laws of the mid-1960s. Somewhat neglected but equally important was the fact that we opened the gates of immigration in the mid-1960s after having slammed them shut for 40 years. And that has produced a different set of anxieties, which takes the form, for example, of a really poisonous debate about immigration policy. Another important feature of contemporary populism is the depiction of taxes as a threat to liberty. And just to show you that there's nothing new, Ronald Reagan described California's Proposition 13, passed in 1978, as, quote, a little bit like dumping those cases of tea off the boat in Boston Harbor. Contemporary politics, in contemporary populism, government is regarded as inept, corrupt, dominated by the special interests against the people's interests, and by overeducated bureaucrats against the public's common sense. It is a government that is regarded as regulation run amok, with environmental regulations and other regulations as a threat not only to liberty but to livelihood. It is a populism, as I said before, defined by a sense of the decline of the manufacturing economy and of the kind of social ordering that a robust manufacturing economy had made possible and had sustained in large portions of the United States. And that has meant that over the past 40 years, the industrial working class, and in particular the male industrial working class, has been the single biggest loser in this period of economic and social transformation, and understandably stands at the heart of the contemporary populist movement. And finally, looking at the distinctive features of the populist upsurge that has occurred really since the beginning of the Obama administration, which I see as continuous with, but in some respects distinct from the one that dominated the 1970s, it is first of all a fiscal populism, with not just taxes but also spending regarded as a threat to liberty. It is a form of populism in which racial resentment is a lot less central than it was 35 or 40 years ago. I say that despite the the rhetorical treatment that has been meted out to the President of the United States in some quarters. Racial resentment is less central, in part because racial attitudes, I think, have loosened very considerably, and in part because a president that I worked for, Bill Clinton, took a lot of racialized populist issues such as crime, welfare, and even affirmative action off or largely off the table. Finally, the political manifestation of populism in today's politics, its core, as I mentioned, is the white working class. The white working class leans conservative. 43% of the white working class calls itself conservative, versus 38% of all Americans. 19% call themselves liberal, substantially less than the portion of Americans as a whole who think of themselves as liberal. Only 36% of them think of themselves as Democrats. 50% regard themselves as Republicans, a much lower figure for Democrats and higher for Republicans than the country as a whole. The white working class makes up 22% of the Republican, rather 39% of the Republican Party, but only 22% of the Democratic Party. The white working class has no love of corporations, but its opposition to government is more intense. And so I think it is a fair judgment to say that the contemporary populists are more opposed to the government bailout of financial corporations than they are to the misdeeds of those corporations themselves. For that reason, among others, I venture the following judgment. Unless or until the record mistrust of government that is now manifested in the United States abates, a mass populism of the left is extremely unlikely to arise. Thank you very much.
I think I don't have much left to say except a kind of description of very rapid description of populism in various European countries, because picture is very diverse. But on the basic issues, I think that both Justin and Bill have said everything which can be said. So I'll obliquely allude to some of the differences or resemblances between European and American populism. But basically, I agree with everything. In Europe, I would like to start with two of the recent news. One which was evoked, Marine Le Pen being in front. I think the second thing with Strauss-Kahn, she's no longer ahead. The first one was without Strauss-Kahn and Hollande, only with Aubry and Sarkozy. It's a very important. The second one, which appeared in last night's Le Monde, which I think is very symbolic, she's going to go to Lampedusa, which is a place where the migrants from Africa arrive, in the company of Mr. Borghieri, who is from the Northern League, who has been indicted before for beating up 12-year-old vendor of something and coming from the south, or perhaps he was a Roma, and for giving fire to an asylum of immigrants. It shows a double thing. Marine Le Pen, her success as opposed to her father, much greater than her father, was that she has been very much sanitizing her message, saying she's for laïcité, secularism, no longer the old traditional Catholics, and inventing something which one could call compassionate racism, because she says these poor migrants from Africa and so on, one accepts them and they are in a terrible condition and so on. I pity them. them, and so on, in a much less aggressive tone than her father, but at the same time, going there with this man, Borghieri, tells, tells a lot. So I'll start with, France and Italy, because of this association, and because also there is another aspect in common, is populism associated to government, in the sense that Sarkozy, like Berlusconi, are embracing populism, are in a way an incarnation of that, and that's the present political problem in France. Sarkozy said in 2007, if we don't have the Le Pen's voters, we are done for. If we have them, we have won. And to a certain extent, it worked. But now it works in the way around. The more he takes subjects which come from Marine Le Pen, the more she gains more than he does. And she said recently, I'm at 20%, but now he's going to have a debate of his, on Islam, and there is a certain kinship between that and the hearings on the radicalization of Islam here. After the debate, I'll have 25% instead of 20. And he had a debate on identity, which again profited to Marine Le Pen much more than to himself. So the same Berlusconi, within the Berlusconi coalition, I think it's a Northern League which is going up at most, and both also in post-war European populism have historical claim. In Italy, it even went into the common language. There was in 1944 brief party called Qualunquismo by journalist Giannini, and with a party, the Uomo Qualunque, the common man, and the slogan was Abbasso tutti, down with all of them. It's the same title which the attempt at left-wing populism in France, former socialist Mélenchon, who now is stronger than the Communist Party, his book is called Qui s'en aille tous, let them all go away. And that was the slogan of the Pujad movement, the tous pourris, all rotten, sortez les sortants, kick the present people out. And Pujad, the first book of my friend and colleague Stanley Hoffman was about the Pujad movement, which was a movement of shopkeepers protesting against the decline of the little shopkeeper and the invasion of the big supermarkets and the big firms and so on, but at the same time, more than usual, against taxes. And the end of the introduction of Stanley Hoffman's book says every time a social category is losing in France, it accuses the state and accuses taxes. And that certainly rings a bell in the American case. So that's France and Italy, with the Liga Nord having something specific which it has in common with the Vlaams bloc in Belgium, that is localism, regionalism, and also some parts of former Yugoslavia. We are the rich productive men and people, and everything goes to the bureaucracy in Rome and to these immigrants from the south. So it's strongly localist. At one point it was pro-European and saying our real compatriots are the Catalans and the people of the more dynamic regions in Europe, what was used to be called the blue banana. Now they are anti-European because they are above all against the migrants, against the Roms, against the Romanians, which they identify with the gypsies and which they want expelled, and so on. So there is the localism, but there is was also a feeling of revanche that they were the people who were despised by bureaucrats and intellectuals of Rome, and now they are richer and they have their revanche. At the same time, they feel they are again dispossessed of their land because they have much unemployment and much immigration, so it's turning more and more, above all, against people from the south, against immigrants, against foreigners. And in general, a French author has coined the word national populism. It's more and more that aspect. If I talk about other places, in the Scandinavian parties started as being anti-tax parties with the huge, extremely progressive tax there, and increasingly it becomes an anti-migrant parties, and particularly against Islam, particularly since the thing of the caricatures of Mohammed and what happened afterwards in Denmark and in all Scandinavia. So it's very diverse, but there are these common themes. Switzerland is a very interesting case because in general they are protectionist. They are against the destruction of the textile industry, about everything by the Chinese and so on. They want protection. But in Switzerland, it's a first party now, and a man named Blücher, who is a great head of a kind of multinational, who is very much for free trade, but very much against the immigrants. And above all, there is a theme against the calls of the Muezzins, against new mosques, like in France, against the burqa, which is forbidden, the veil, all these things. It's concentrating, I think, more and more into an anti-Islamic movement. And finally, and that there are also with the impact of the immigrants and this feeling which you had very much, for instance, in the south of France, this is where Le Pen had his big gains, and people in Marseille and so on, it's no longer our city, it's full of Arabs, we don't recognize our habitat and our customs and so on. And leads also to the discussion around multiculturalism, where which is now the great enemy. Germans and the British, there was a French model of integration and the German and British model of more communitarism and multiculturalism, and Mrs. Merkel has said officially multiculturalism was a big failure, and there is more or less also this kind of revision in Germany, in Britain, and the idea of a light culture, that the old French idea was anybody can be a Frenchman. We are not ethnic in the sense of racial, but famous thing which the French historian Michelet had written, but you have to forget your tradition, you have to forget your culture, and you have to venerate Joan of Arc and Napoleon and so on, to acquire a new culture. The trend was that precisely the Muslims are less prone to adapt in that way than were the waves of Italians and Poles, although there were assassinations and riots when they were coming into France at the beginning of the century. But still, that is also a theme. Finally, Eastern Europe is interesting also because the a few years ago, the country which was giving the greatest worry to European institutions and to liberal circles was Austria with Haider. And still his party collapsed, but still they are the first party in Vienna, if I'm not mistaken. And it reminds one a little bit, there is a remarkable book about Hitler's Vienna, about the reaction against the cosmopolitanism and the people coming from Russia and so on, Jews in particular, and so on. And there is something like that, again, the feeling of being invaded in a big city like Vienna. But now it's Hungary. And Hungary, of course, everyone brings his own claim to being a victim. And Hungary has, after World War I, lost 2/3 of its territory. And that's a curse which always comes back. And now there is a really fascist party which has marches in uniform and which organizes expedition against gypsy villages and is anti-Semitic also and so on. And the government is also using, like Sarkozy, the fact, well, we are stealing their fire and hence we are protecting you against them. But it's by adopting part of their program. There is a little bit like something like that in Bulgaria, whose tradition is not at all right-wing, unless Romania or Poland. They have now a party called ATAKA, who is both anti-Turkish, anti-Gypsy and anti-Semitic, everything together, but they have a president who is fighting against corruption, and he's a real fighter because he was a bodyguard of the communist prime minister Zhukov Borisov. So he's a former fighter and he leads the fight against corruption, but not in a way which one would which inspires much confidence. And in Eastern Europe, here I come a little bit to the general problem. It's a particular case where there was no real political debate. At least in Poland and in Hungary, the former communists have become social democrats, and from social democrats, the warmest proponents of capitalism, of NATO, of everything else. And the great thing was European enter into the West, NATO, European Union, and to adopt that. So there was no real political debate. And I remember writing an article in the winter of 89-90, when people in France were saying social democracy the third way will be the way of Eastern Europe. One expected the social democrats, and it was the opposite. And it was normal that after having had the communism stagnation, super authoritarian police in the state, they looked at Reagan, Thatcher, complete capitalism, kind of dismantling of the state. But it was foreseeable that that would be only a time. Inequalities increased, the working class was rather the loser in that, while the intellectuals were the winners. And I think the big question is what will come afterwards? Will it be a kind of a compromise between plan, market, and so on? Will it be a return of the communist, or will it be a fascist temptation, saying it's a fault of the foreigners, of the Jews, or whatever? So it varies from country to country. Poland, which seemed to be with our brothers Kaczynski, the most traditionalist and nationalist, now has a perfectly reasonable right of center capitalist but open government. But in Hungary and in the Balkans, you have this, and you have a disaffection with this enthusiasm for the European Union, as well as for the West, and even for America, which was a great hope on their side. So a very diverse situation, but the predominant things, it seems to me, are two things: the consequences, social and economic consequences of globalization on the one hand, and cultural and psychological feeling of dispossession and the search for scapegoats against that. It seems to me, if I may end with something more general, there is something in populism which is always a possibility of democracy, because there is democracy as we understand it, constitutional democracy works when the institutions work, when there is mediation between the elite and the people. The two temptations can be either oligarchy, people who are in the name of the people but don't consult the people and in the name of the people look at their own interest, or on the other hand, the populism, the search for a direct power of something ill-defined, which is the people and which is defined negatively against the elites or against the foreigners, which is in a way wants to be unanimous, but in a way restricts the field of solidarity. It seems to me very often that we don't have really politics, that there is a crisis of representative democracy of the institutions, and hence the two, one has more attitudes, technocracy, elitist technocracy in the name of constraints, the market, and so on, versus populism and particularism, national, ethnic, and so on, or globalism, cosmopolitanism, and so on. And there can be different combinations. They may be different in Europe and in America to some extent. Secondly, this is increased by globalization, and by the economic tensions which are created by that, and basically that was the case in the interwar period, that the working class was more to the left, communist, socialist, and the decaying middle classes produced fascism. Now we have decaying middle classes, but also, as Bill emphasized, in France also most of the workers vote for Le Pen. Many people went directly from communism to Le Pen. In America, it's very striking. Again, I was struck by that theme which Bill had at the end, that at the beginning with the AIG and so on, you had the mainstream against Main Street against Wall Street, and scandal against the bonuses and so on. And in fact, this has more or less vanished, and it's against the government, against spending, and against again the immigrants or the people on welfare, against those who work, and so on. It's an interesting displacement, perhaps even more in America than in Europe, to see the enemy and cause or the scapegoat, depending on one's own analysis, against the greater inequalities. One looks more to the against against the people who are outside or who are below, than to the people who are prospering when one loses one's house and or one's living. So that I think indicates some of the of the common things, but also perhaps some of the differences which will surface in the discussion.
Thank Great. You. Thanks, Pierre. Before we start the discussion, I have two questions. One, the first one is for Bill. At the beginning of last month, Pastor Terry Jones, the ones who wanted to burn the Quran on the anniversary of 9/11, was refused entrance to the UK. He wanted to take part in a conference or a protest movement against the Islamization of Europe in a sort of international that included, in particular, Geert Wilders, the Dutch politician. It seems, and Pierre mentioned that in his presentation, that anti-Islam feelings are common to each and every populist movement in Europe right now, pretty much the same way that anti-Semitism in the 1930s was common to absolutely all, at least right-wing and sometimes left-wing populist movements. What is the situation on the U.S. side? Until the summer of 2010, there was not many signs of this. And then there was the New York mosque controversy. Of course, now there are the, you know, legitimate hearings on the Hill, but which raise question on how they are sort of presented and framed, and it seems that this theme of anti-Islam has been picking up in the U.S. So how do you assess that element of current American populisms?
That is a, from an empirical standpoint, a very complicated question. I've begun to take a look at American public opinion vis-a-vis Muslims, and it is it's a variegated picture. I do know this based on very recent surveys that anti-Muslim feeling is more pervasive right now on the right than it is in the left in the United States. But I would speculate that the recent events in the Maghreb and in the Middle East may have a very positive effect over time on America's attitudes towards Muslims and the Muslim world because of the public face that those movements have presented to the United States and the world. I mean, these are people who are speaking a very, very familiar political language, who are not, at least publicly, mounting an insurgency in the name of Islam, in the name of the installation of Sharia law. The absence of anti-American slogans in Egypt, particularly, where one might have expected them during that entire insurrectionary period, was really striking, right? Would that my own political party were capable of as much message discipline, you know, as the hundreds of thousands of people, you know, who went through Tahrir Square. I mean, it was extraordinary, and I can only believe that they weren't saying it because it wasn't really uppermost in their minds. Right, they may not like the relationship over the past three decades between Mubarak and the United States. They may not like our stance in the Israeli-Palestinian controversy or our support of Mubarak in no small measure because he helped sustain our position in that controversy. But they didn't give voice to those sentiments. That has not been the dominant stance throughout the Muslim world during this period of promising, if indefinable and unpredictable, political change. And so I think it is at least possible that, you know, American populism will manage to avoid what Pierre neatly defined as the trifecta, you know, of anti-Islamic sentiment, anti-Gypsy sentiment, and anti-Semitism that's characteristic of many European populist movements.
Yeah, I agree with you, but being a natural pessimist, I was struck, like everyone else, and by what you just described in the demonstrations, and I think that is something really which has changed, including for myself, the view of the Arab world, that there is a class of particularly young people and influenced partly also by the diasporas, by communications and so on, which are people like us who want the same as thing like us and so on. On the other hand, you already had now a fight between Copts and Muslims and a church burned and certain deaths here and there. This can be transformed, and you know, the many people who are anti-immigrant are beginning to be against them, you know, even more than against these categories, because they look like us, but in fact they are not like us. And one sees already people saying, oh, all that, it's signed because it was the Muslim Brothers who were behind it and they imposed that discipline and so on. I think that's false, but it may very well be that the image with the next terror act and so on, or the next disorder in the countries, that these reactions will still be there. And in general, I know Justin and my our mutual friend Olivier Roy are very optimistic about the integration of the Muslims. I think so also, but for the majority, but in most revolutions and so on, minorities who want to inflame things are as important as good feelings of the majorities. And I think on both sides there are enough people who may sabotage and blur this positive image which has come recently.
Offer a very brief cultural commentary on a very interesting point that you just made. You described the fears that, well, they may look like us, but they're not really like us. There was a famous American film from the early 1950s, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, during the height of the anti-communist hysteria, which was on exactly that theme. They may look like us, but they're not like us.
I had a question for Pierre. So if populism is anti-elitism and the feeling of being dispossessed of political power and the power to affect one's destiny, certainly the rise of technology and the availability of information and the increased transparency of governments should have helped, but it doesn't really look like that. So what's the relationship between technology on the one hand and populism on the other hand?
Well, basically, I think in a way it helps spreading populist movement, because in a way it's part of democratization that you don't have to listen to the elites, you don't have your information checked and prepared by newspapers or by experts. You have the internet. I was seeing yesterday a statistic about the great multiplication of hate groups in America by internet. Anybody, any crackpot can say anything he wants on internet, and the media, people who like Glenn Beck say that Obama has an innate hatred of white people, or that what happened there was a result of a conspiracy of of Al-Qaeda plus the liberals and so on to get rid of the United States or anything like that, can be reproduced enormously. So internet had a great effect, particularly Facebook and so on what happened in Egypt and Tunisia, but it really goes both ways. And that's a feature of our world, that information can be much less controlled. So I see what you mean in the sense that one sees the rest of the world, one cannot be as parochial as before. But it's interesting that the more there is globalization, the more one can have contact with instant contact with everything. It works very well for stock exchange and so on. It works, we've seen, also for revolution, although in 1848 it spread through Europe with different motivations before the internet and so on. But in general, if you look at the foreign coverage in the newspapers, including the New York Times or Le Monde, in general, the more people are exposed to the whole world, the more they want to retreat on their on the problems of their vicinity and of their category, and so on. When you look at television, besides the specialized channels like BBC World or so on, you are struck by very often how much local news or human interest news are more than the other. So I can only say there are some categories which are encouraged, and they can be people who discover their common preoccupations, or I want to say the word values, because my education forbids me, but the common and attitudes and beliefs. But the more also it produces a retraction in other categories.
Okay, there are still many other questions that I would like to ask to Pierre and Bill. For example, the comparison between anti-Washington sentiment, which is a feature of American political culture in general, but in particular populist groups, and anti-Brussels rhetoric among all populist groups in Europe. And if you think the two are perhaps comparable, even though they don't necessarily come from the same political culture, or the role of nationalism in the American and the European populist movements, and many other interesting questions. But I think it's more fair now at this point to leave the floor to you for questions, which we'll probably take by rounds of three. So please, you know the rules, identify yourself and make sure there's a question mark at the end of your sentence. We'll start with Emiliano over there at the back of the room.
Thank you, Emiliano Alessandri from the German Marshall Fund. Thanks for the very comprehensive presentations. There are three points that I haven't really heard in your presentations. I understand that they would require long answers, but I'll be satisfied with whatever you can provide. One is the relationship between these populist movements and history. You know, they have been presented by both of you as, you know, fundamentally backward-looking movements. I would add to that they look at the past. They try to restore a past that probably never was, because they can't really face a future that they will never accept. My question is, did they ever win? Did any of these movements ever win, or they just delayed processes of change? Second question is the leadership of these movements. I'm from Italy. Berlusconi was mentioned in this respect. It strikes me that, you know, some of these populist leaders are not really the common man. I mean, Berlusconi presents himself as a common man, as a friend of the moderates, but he's definitely not a common man. He's the richest, one of the richest men in Europe, and is definitely an extremist when it comes to moral behavior and, you know, political views in many ways. So, you know, are there similarities throughout history in the way these populist movements select their own elite, and are there similarities among elites? Which leads me to the third point, possible international alliances of these movements, given that this is a transatlantic discussion on populism. My opinion is that, you know, these movements are often focused on domestic issues, and they're kind of parochial, so they're not interested in building bridges with other similar movements. They have similar but separate agendas. But are there connections internationally? I think we're seeing that in the European Union, because, of course, in the European Parliament, you have all these different groups that may agree on some stances. But again, how would you assess the possibility of cooperation among these movements?
Thanks. A few ranks in the middle here, Carrie. The gentleman with the beard, and then his neighbors.
My name is Clark Reinstein. I'm retired. I had a question on why all these populist movements are conservative as opposed to being on the left. And correlate to that is why the working class turned conservative versus more left-leaning.
Next to you, Norman.
Yes. I'm Norman Birnbaum. Thanks for this terrific tour de horizon. But I've got two questions for each side of the Atlantic. For Bill, we had phenomena like Upton Sinclair, Huey Long, who scared Franklin Roosevelt very much, Father Coughlin's people used to sell a publication called Social Justice on the streets of New York. In other words, we had different forms of left-wing, anti-capitalist populism, and at the moment it's quite true that Tea Party movement and associated movements certainly endorse their own version of capitalism. But given economic crisis, is it possible that there might be another American variant of populism? And for Pierre Hastner, what about Sarkozy is terribly afraid of the Pen candidacy, but don't the socialists and the parties of the left have equal reason to worry? That is to say that she's fishing in their reservoir of votes, and could not one envisage in Europe a strong nationalistic, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, anti-capitalist party with, as you say, the focus on Brussels as the site of all malevolence.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think the last two questions in particular had strong coherence, and then there were the three questions put out by Emiliano, so why don't we start with this? Maybe, Pierre, you could start.
Which of the first ones or the last ones?
Your pick.
I don't know. Well, just now, the last ones, I think partly we mentioned that, but to me, as I was saying a little bit, there is something slightly mystifying to, in my opinion, the kind of regulated capitalism, which was out of fashion in general, and a little bit before the crisis, everybody in France and in Germany was talking flexibility and so on, and taking America as a model, but has to a great extent or should have suffered from the crisis. The Greenspan said as much that he was flabbergasted. He thought the market could regulate itself, and it didn't happen that way. So I think this view was right against communism, was right against unfettered, unregulated capitalism, but yet is nowhere profiting from the crisis. The crisis goes more towards right-wing populism. And in a way, it's a mystery to me. The ones the inventor of the Southern strategy for the Republicans, Kevin Phillips, he changed his mind, and he kept writing books about the politics of rich and poor, saying the inequalities have gone so much and we've become a nation of borrowers and so on. There must be a reaction, and it doesn't come. It looked a little bit like that, as I said, at the beginning of the crisis. There was outrage against the bonuses, and now, as Bill said, very rightly, there has been shift, finding an old American tradition, which about government being the problem and not the solution, and about taxes and so on. So this is a difference with Europe. The Europeans don't very often in Greece, in Italy, if they can, they don't pay their taxes, but they are not against it. The taxes is a matter of principle. So it is a difference. So this famous book, Whatever Happened to Kansas, apparently was wrong in the specific analysis of the results, but saying this has been another, this, if you want, this is a left-wing conspiracy theory, the capitalists have succeeded in turning the anger not against themselves, but against the government or against the spending for the unemployed or whatever, rather than against the deregulation which has produced the thing in the first place. There is something like that, but there is very much also that socialism and all that has been discredited by the Soviet experience, that the social democrats, who have been among the first victims of the communist regimes, but somehow have been tainted by the defeat of socialism, and have nothing to offer but a little bit more regulation and so on. I think that would be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to reflect on that?
Well, why don't I just, you know, briskly run through my answers to the questions on offer, at least some of them, just to be fair to all. With regard to the first questioner, do I expect a populist international, a pop-in turn, to take shape, anytime soon? No, I don't. For the very simple reason that because populist movements tend to be particularist, not only in their ideas but also in their sentiments, there can be contagion effects. And there may be occasional exchanges of ideas. But as an organized international political movement, I doubt it. I doubt it very much. Ever victorious? Well, reflecting on some of the populist struggles in the United States in the 1970s, for example, against school busing. That's an example of a particular and partial victory, but one where people representing local communities, many of which, to quote then-candidate Jimmy Carter, were ethnically pure, were able ultimately to defend themselves against what appeared to be an overwhelming, you know, phalanx of legislature, executive, and even the courts. With regard to a future for left-wing populism, Norman, in my remarks, I did note that the populism of the 1930s was a populism of the left. Let me give you a much brisker answer than your question deserves. It seems to me that any left movement, to some considerable extent, must be a movement or a party of government. And so I simply repeat what I said at the end of my remarks. Unless and until the public's regard for government rises very substantially from the near record lows at which it now stands, I think a populism of the left is inconceivable. Or to put it slightly differently, as long as people reflecting on the offenses of corporations and the offenses of bureaucrats say with great reluctance, I choose the offenses of the corporations, as long as that prevails, no. With regard to the flip side, the question from the gentleman in the aisle seat. Why has populism in the United States in the past 40 years principally been a conservative phenomenon? Not entirely, but principally. Answer, because the forces against which the populists were fighting, starting from the late 1960s on, were seen as forces unleashed by a new kind of liberalism. And so they defined themselves against that. You know, whether it was a movement from a growth economics to a very aggressive economics of redistribution, whether it took the form of laws and regulations enforced by courts against local majorities, I could go on and on, and to say nothing of the fact that many of the most prominent and I would say epic defining social movements of the past 40 years, have been ones that not only offered very little to the traditional manufacturing and working classes, but in some very real respects defined themselves against those classes. So it is no accident, comrade, that the populism of the United States in the past 40 years has been principally a populism of the right. And I expect that to continue for quite some time.
Okay, since I don't want to be cast as a lamestream elite, illegitimate one, and I don't want a populist revolt in the room, I will take more than three questions because there are many of you who want to ask questions. And so I will ask you to make your questions very short, but we'll really go around the room and leave a bit less time for Pierre and Bill to answer. Can you start with the gentleman here and then go around?
Bruce Smith, Brookings Retired. I've been reading this very interesting book, Harold Perkin, The Rise of Professional Society, in which he recounts sort of the transition from, to make it quick, from first landed aristocracy, capitalist order, and to a kind of professional order, rise of the middle class, education, higher education, universities wedded to the welfare states. Now he says in his 2002 preface to the edition, well, now how do we account for this sort of, you know, the split within the meritocracy? Well, his view is it's the right wing, as Pierre was saying a moment ago, that's challenging the government class. So it's the right wing meritocracy challenging the left wing meritocracy. But I have a different query for the colleagues. Is this perhaps an exaggeration in what we're really talking about? And I think Dick Hofstadter used to argue with him. He's my colleague. The paranoid style in American politics was a vast exaggeration. So maybe the populism we're seeing now really is an invention of the left to try to rescue the government party and blame the populace for challenging government.
Okay, on this side, can you start with the gentleman here with the blue T-shirt? Please.
Yeah, Kenneth Rothschild, independent. My question basically is around, could we be approaching a period where governance itself becomes really problematic? When you're in a great period of change, whatever, you look at France, you look at Russia, you look at any place, there oftentimes is a lot of disruption in the transition. And out of the disruption oftentimes comes very authoritarian wave like Stalin and people like that who basically settle things down, so to speak. So my question is, what do you see coming and what level of just lack of ability to govern well could be coming in the future, and where do you see that going?
Thanks. Could you pass to the gentleman behind you?
Yep. Thank you. Dieter Dettke, Georgetown University. Question for Pierre, and maybe also a comment from Bill Galson. He might know something about that too. How much do you think the anti-bailout populism in Europe can become a real political force and a real risk for European integration? You could see it a year ago in Germany, before the May elections in North Rhine-Westphalia. The CDU was pretty much penetrated by, an anti-bailout populism. You can see it now in Scandinavia and the northern European countries. Wait for Finland and the electoral results in Finland. And you could see that there's something brewing that could really, I wouldn't say endanger European integration, but set some limits of decision making and, you know, lead to some sort of paralysis of, you know, the institutional makeup of the European Union. Thank you.
Thanks. Could you pass to the lady behind you with the green jacket? Thanks.
This has been a wonderful presentation. This is Elaine Sorreo. I'm a Franklin Fellow at the Department of State. And so I have sort of a two-part question, one for each of you. So given the pressure of the populist resurgence in the United States and its effect, as we've just seen, on the electorate of our U.S. Congress, and this coupled with our fiscal crisis, do you see any serious movement of the press to provide pressure to Congress to significantly reduce foreign aid in all areas but the most catastrophic humanitarian assistance? And then second, what would that mean globally to our relations with our other bilateral donors?
Mm-hmm. Could you pass to the back of the room, the gentleman standing over there?
Thanks. Hilo Fratkin of the Hudson Institute. I guess I want to pursue Bill a little bit on your notion that populism is going to be remain of the left, most likely. And I was wondering in what...
The right.
I'm sorry, of the right. But I was wondering what you... in what category you would put, for example, the most recent demonstrations in Wisconsin and what... relationship that would bear to your scheme of populism. And the other thing, you reminded us of the book The Paranoid Style. And as has often been observed, we paranoids are occasionally correct. There are elites that hate our guts. And what's made it somewhat more aggravating is their apparent incompetence, whether of government or corporations. I mean, the crisis of 2008, where bankers who we were told were the most conservative and scrupulous people there were turned out to be quite foolish, if not downright idiots. And political leadership also seems to be very weak. So one can treat populism as simply a kind of simply irrational, but it seems to arise in this particular case and probably some others from objective circumstances that support it.
Thanks. Okay, on the back, the gentleman here, PL.
Alex Pritera with German TV N24. My question is basically a follow-up. How much of this recent populism is merely linked to the economic crisis that we're witnessing, and how much of that will likely recede once growth rates, particularly in this country, will reach a level that can absorb a substantial amount of unemployed people. And maybe a comparison with the European situation, where this populism, this recent populism, seems to have been around for slightly longer. Where is this likely to go? How will it develop? And is it also a reflection of the somewhat stagnant economy of the past 10 or 15 years?
Or 30 years, yep. I mean, the Front National arose in 1983, after all. Here. Could you stand up and identify yourself?
Sorry. Anne Daguerre, French researcher, observer of the Tea Party movement. I just have a question regarding, and it touches on what Pierre Asner said, the idea that, at least in the United States, there seems to be a conflict, or the notion that there is a special interest, a conflict of interest between corporations and government is a big theme on the left traditionally, but hasn't been taken up at all. And could you comment on this?
Thanks. I think we can take one last question. And there's no more questions. Yes, there is. Here.
If you ask for one, you'll always get one.
Okay. First of all, moderators.
My name is Carlos Ferreira. I'm from Spain. And I would like to ask, what do you think about populist movements of Latin America, like Chavez and so on? Because, well, they are considered populist, but they don't fit exactly in the definition of populism you have made. For example, they are expensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Okay, so we have a wealth of interventions and questions, and obviously we won't be able to do justice to all of them, especially because there are only 2 minutes left, but I suggest we stretch a bit the time and go until 3:35, and I would like to let each of you a chance to answer by cherry-picking the questions that you'd like to answer. Maybe, Bill, you want to start?
Well, as a sort of liberal, I would prefer to be fair to each and every question rather than cherry picking. But I probably won't be. So let me begin by answering the ones that I can answer pretty easily and then move on to the ones that will be much more difficult. Foreign aid is indeed a target, and it's not simply confined to populists. It's been a target for a very long time, and in these circumstances, I think you can expect very substantial cuts. I will not venture to say where they'll fall, but I think I think that it will be substantial. Is contemporary populism a fiction, produced by the partisans of government to defend government? I would hesitate to describe the Tea Party as a fiction created by the partisans of government. I think it is a fact created by the actions of government, but that's a very different thesis. With regard to populism, Latin American style, in Venezuela and elsewhere. I think one has to look at the way governing elites in Venezuela and elsewhere conducted themselves when they did have the power to create more inclusive social policy, and for whatever reasons, short-sightedness or self-interests or some other reasons, chose not to, generating a substantial pool of resentment, which provided, we must confess, a mass base for the Chavez's, which is not to defend him. I am vehemently opposed to him and all of his works, but there were historical antecedents to the rise of Chavez. As to your question, sir, about the challenges to governance as a whole. Speaking as a senior fellow in governance studies, I couldn't agree more that question is very much on the table. How can modern mass constitutional democracies successfully govern themselves in the circumstances that we now face? I think we'll come up with answers, but we are in a period in which existing governance structures are not functioning very well. And if I had a few more hours, I'd explain, why I think that. And finally, to my old friend Hillel Fradkin's very interesting intervention, you are not the first to speculate that events in Wisconsin could be the harbinger of a somnolent union movement at last waking up and doing something to protect itself against complete obliteration. I have an email file now full of emails that I've gotten in the past week raising some version of that question. And, I will give you the classic journalistic answer. Time will tell. I will say this. Given the template that I've brought to the analysis of the whole thing, populism tends to arise when people are afraid that something they care about very much is about to be taken away from them. And for organized labor, collective bargaining rights are that thing. So, and clearly, if you look at some of the public opinion surveys, while Governor Walker and others receive
strong majority support for the idea that public sector workers should give back something while everybody else is making such sacrifices. An equally strong supermajority, a 2-to-1 supermajority, opposes the idea that government should take away collective bargaining rights from organized labor. So this is clearly, to that extent, an overreach, and overreaches tend to produce political reactions. How pervasive they turn out to be, I can't tell you. With regard to paranoids and real enemies, I couldn't agree more, and the analysis that I gave of populism in America was not intended to be reductionist in any way. And I invoked Hofstadter's essay for a very distinct purpose, to point to a fringe phenomenon where conspiracy theories take over from legitimate grievances, however they may be articulated. And I will say this. And I don't intend this as a partisan comment. I think the birther fringe of contemporary populism fits Hofstadter's definition. I think the thesis that that Obama is basically a secret Kenyan who hates white people, a thesis that's been articulated not only by Glenn Beck, but in the pages of an elite journal that you and I have both been known to read, I do not take this as manifestations of a legitimate populism, right? It's something else entirely, and that's something else entirely that I pointed to. Indeed, I think I went out of my way in my presentation to emphasize that the populism of the past 40 years rests on real phenomena in the economy and real grievances. So the reverse of reductionism, it seems to me.
I'll answer directly on Europe, and if I may, it's in danger of extending even over the 35 minutes, end up also in my way on where Bill ended. I don't think there will be a kind of alliance of xenophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-everything overcoming Europe, but I think the tendencies are strong, and I think the European integration, because of that, among other things, is in real trouble. There is a renationalization of politics, and the examples which you quoted are particularly from Germany, but there is now, with the extension, there is a greater diversification in the economic level and economic interests of various countries, and very normally, the Germans who are in the best situation are sick and tired of, while they have see themselves as having been virtuous, paying for people who haven't paid their taxes and have lied about their statistics and so on. So there are these divisive things. And in general, I think the great enemy of populism is complexity. And European Union, Sarkozy is trying a little bit now, as Mitterrand succeeded in 1988, to present Europe as a protection against the hazards of globalization and so on, but it's not taken like that. It's taken like the Trojan horse of globalization. It let free movement, so all the gypsies of Romania and Bulgaria come into France, and they are hesitant on their economic policies. Some are pro-capitalistic, some are protectionist. But basically, the European Union is distant, bureaucratic, and I think it's really in trouble because of that. There is collaboration, more than has been said, between these various movements. I started with Marine Le Pen and Mr. Man from the Northern League going together to Lampedusa, and she's going to go in all kinds of countries. But basically, an alliance of nationalisms is always difficult because the antagonism. Now, my last word is twofold. one Europe and America, I think Europeans certainly don't have a right to lecture Americans, because America has saved, not only has saved Europe, but has saved itself in the sense that it didn't have, it was spared both communism and fascism, Nazism, both totalitarian movements. And as Justin was quoting, I always say crisis of 29 gave Roosevelt in America and Hitler in Germany. But this being said, today there is a level of pure craziness and conspiracy theory which I cannot see an example in Europe among the most extremist movements and among the people who have the greatest audience in the States. How many millions has Mr. Beckwith, three sessions about the secret puppet master George Soros, or about what has been quoted, or about what happened in Egypt is part of this conspiracy, and so on. And there are many examples like that. So, or I myself saw Mr. Pat Robertson, who has a very dignified allure, saying I have a research group and don't quote me, make me say more than I say. It's only 90% from our research. It's not yet definitive, but 90% of our research is that the hurricane, the tornado which now is ravaging Florida, is due to the number of abortions in the United States. But it's not definitive. Our research really seems to show that. That is unknown in Europe. So each of the two has to reflect. But the common thing is this contrast between populism, who wants simple answers and who is essentially manichaeistic, and the complexity of the world. Some of you may have seen the recent article by Walter Russell Mead in Foreign Affairs, which says, after all, it's better than after the war. One had to exaggerate the communist conspiracies that produced McCarthyism, but essentially they were isolationists. They went along with what the enlightened leaders said the communist. Yes, but on the one hand, the world was much less complicated, and on the other hand, through to internet, to all these other, also the special interests behind it, there is a much greater latitude, which is good, because people, when we like it, we say it's the people in Facebook has helped the people in the Arab countries. When you don't like it, we say it's very hard to govern that way. And the basic thing, the crisis of representative institutions, including in particular for the most the country which has the greatest number of responsibilities, America, the way Congress functions, its rules and so on, the risks of paralysis and so on, are more and more serious, and the same thing for European integration. So in an age of complexity, I think populism has still a great future, and it's a future which looks towards the past, but which may influence the future in an unpredictable but dangerous way.
Pierre, that was a great conclusion. Please join me in thanking both Pierre and Bill for a great discussion, and sorry for running over time.